A large recent survey in the UK asked what words people associated with Jesus. The top choices were spiritual, loving, peaceful, wise, and inspirational. And those are good words to describe Jesus. But how about divisive? In our passage this morning, Jesus miraculously brings sight to a man born blind. And in verse 9, his neighbours are divided. Some said, it is he. Others said, no, but he's like him. In verse 16, the Pharisees are divided. Some said, X, but others said, Y. And there was a division among them. In verse 22, the community is divided. Some will remain in the synagogue, but if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. And for that reason, the healed man's parents effectively disown him. There is division within his family. Jesus says that he has come to earth this first time to bring judgment. Not the judgment of eternal condemnation, he will bring that at his second coming, but the judgment of division. Verse 39, Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. One commentator says this: this chapter portrays what happens when Jesus the light shines. Some are made to see, like this man born blind, while others who think they see turn away, blinded, as it were, by the light. So how about divisive as a word to describe Jesus? That survey I mentioned is mostly about evangelism, Christians telling non-Christians about Jesus. And amongst other things, we learn that after such conversations, 23% of the non-Christians felt more positive about Jesus, but 30% felt more negative about him. The authors of the report comment underneath that statistic, apparently with a straight face. We must recognise here that even Jesus himself, when speaking to people in the first century, was not well received 100% of the time. This is the Jesus who was crucified by those who had received him slightly less than 100% well. The overall tone of the report as a whole is that if we can start to do evangelism right, we won't need to suffer rejection. But don't worry, they say, not even Jesus got it right all the time. But John chapter 9 says that Jesus is divisive. And that truth is the encouragement that I need to get on with evangelism. Even if I do everything right, as Jesus always did, I will face rejection and opposition on his behalf. But even if I do almost everything wrong in my evangelism, God can use my weak efforts to open people's eyes to the truth about Jesus. John includes this story in his gospel because he is trying to convince us that Jesus is the Messiah, the Christ, God's long-promised King for the world. The prophet Isaiah had always said that the one to come would open the eyes of the blind, and now Jesus does. This miracle demonstrates beyond question that Jesus is the Messiah. You would have to be blind not to see it. But this chapter tells us that that is precisely the problem. Each of us by nature is spiritually blind, and it takes a miracle for Jesus to open our blind eyes so that we can see the truth about who he is. What sort of person will he do that for? Well, we'll see that the one who is given sight is the one who is willing to trust and obey Jesus' words. Those who remain blind are those who, in their pride, refuse to listen to Jesus. Let's work our way through the passage in six scenes. If you've got a chicken in the oven, the first scene is the longest, so don't panic. If you've shut your Bibles, open them again to page 1079, John chapter 9, and we start with the miracle itself. Scene 1, verses 1 to 7, the divine sign. Look at the passage with me as I read. Verse 1, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? The disciples are reflecting a widespread view of their time that suffering and disability are the direct result of a specific sin. They're a bit puzzled because this man is born blind. And so either he suffered his punishment before he committed his sin, or God is punishing his parents, both of which seem a bit weird. So they ask Jesus what's going on. Verse 3, Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. There are instances in the Bible where God uses illness to punish disobedience or to discipline his own people. But that isn't the general case. Suffering, illness and disability are reminders that we live in a world broken by sin. But there isn't a one-to-one correspondence between a sinful act and an instance of suffering. God has reasons for doing everything that he does. He rarely tells us what those reasons are, but in this case he tells us that this man was born blind so that he might be healed and also become a walking billboard advertising that Jesus is the Messiah doing the works of God his Father. Jesus continues, verse 4, "We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Jesus repeats his claim from chapter 8 that he is the light of the world, enabling people to know and to obey God. Jesus has a brief period of about 3 years of ministry that climax in his death and resurrection and ascension. This brief period is Jesus' working day, a day marked not by the presence of the Son, S-U-N, but by the presence of the Son, S-O-N. I was quite pleased with that. And what better miracle for the light of the world to perform than to open the eyes of a man born blind. Verse 6, having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Why does Jesus use mud in the healing of this man when he could have just healed him with a word as he does elsewhere? I'm not persuaded there's anything significant about mud itself as a substance, but I think there are three significant effects of Jesus doing the healing this way rather than with a word. I'm just going to tell you one of them now, and you can really look forward to finding out what the other two are in the next few minutes. Here's the first significance of the mud. It means that the man has to obey Jesus in order to get healed. If Jesus had healed him with a word, we wouldn't be able to see the man's attitude to Jesus. But Jesus, the one sent by his Father, put mud on this man's eyes and sent him to the pool called Sent. And we discover that the man was willing to trust and obey Jesus' words. Because rather than just politely wiping the mud off his eyes and going about his business, he went where he was sent and he washed as he was commanded and he came back seeing. Jesus gives spiritual sight to the person who is willing to trust and obey his words. Actually, even that willingness is a gift from God that we can't generate within ourselves. But the key thing here is that it works this way round. We can only see the truth that Jesus is the Messiah if we are already willing to trust and obey his words. Our will comes before our intellect. We tend to think it's the other way round. We think if I were absolutely convinced that Jesus were the Messiah, then of course I'd consider doing what he commands. But first he has to prove himself to me. Well, that won't work. We need first to be willing to be obedient. And then we'll be able to understand who Jesus is. Jesus said the same in the previous chapter in verse 17. He said, "If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority." Will precedes intellect. There are some here not yet convinced that Jesus is God's Messiah, God's King for the world. Well, be honest with yourself. Would you be willing to obey him if you became convinced? Or are there certain deal breakers, non-negotiables? Becoming a Christian would mean you had to stop sleeping with your girlfriend or your boyfriend. Are you willing to consider that? It might mean pretty major changes to your finances. Are you willing to consider that? It would certainly mean giving up your pride. Are you willing to consider that? If you're not willing to obey Jesus' words, you will never see him for who he is. Pray that God would give you that willingness. And when we become a Christian, that remains our prayer. When I read the Bible each morning, I don't just pray, "Lord, help me to understand what I'm about to read." Because if I'm aiming only for understanding, I probably won't get it. I pray, "Lord, make me willing to obey what I find in your word," because then there's a chance that I'll understand it right too. Our will comes before our intellect. Jesus gives spiritual sight to those who are willing to trust and obey his words. as he gives physical sight to this man who went where he was sent. That's sign one, the divine sign. On to scene two, the dubious neighbours, verses 8 to 12. Notice that from verse 8 all the way through to verse 34, Jesus is nowhere to be found. If you can find a longer stretch in any of the Gospels that hasn't got Jesus in it, let me know. I can't think of one. Jesus is absent on purpose. He ensures that the healing itself and the early days of this man's new life take place in his absence. How does Jesus do that? Well, he smears him with mud and sends him away to wash. Why does he do that? So that the man can be a good illustration for believers throughout history of the normal Christian experience. You've been very patient, but there is the second significance to the mud. It gets Jesus out of the way so that this man can illustrate for us the normal Christian experience. With Jesus physically absent, this man has to represent him and field questions and face opposition that would have been directed at Jesus himself if he'd been around. And that is our experience today following Jesus. We'll see that actually having to fend for himself helps this man to grow, and it will help us to grow. Let's see how people respond to the healing of this man from verse 8. Verse 8, the neighbours and those who'd seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he's like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." I hate those conversations with banks where you have to sort of try and demonstrate that you are you. It feels so upside down. I told someone my date of birth the other day and he said, "Yes, that's right." And I said, "Yes, I know. That, I'm kind of the authority on this topic." "Are you sure you're you?" they say to the man. Quite sure, he says. Verse 10, so they said to him, "Well, then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I don't know." If you ever watch a Channel 4 documentary on the Bible, it won't be long before you hear a presenter say, "Of course, in those pre-scientific days, people were much more susceptible to rumours of alleged miracles." What offensively patronising bunk. These dubious neighbours are as modern as you or I. They'd sooner deny that this man is this self-evidently the same man than admit that a miracle has happened. They're entirely respectable modern sceptics, and they ought to give us modern sceptics great confidence that this miracle really did happen. Well, the dubious neighbours still don't know what to make of all this, so they cart him off to the wisest people they can think of, the community leaders and the Pharisees. Scene 3. Verses 13 to 17, the divided Pharisees. Verse 13, they brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. John has saved this important fact for this point in the story. God's Old Testament law forbade working on the Sabbath, which was a good law, it was God's law. But even within the law, there were exceptions in times of emergency. For example, the Sabbath was a good law for normal time, but this isn't normal time. Jesus said in verse 4, "We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day." This is sunshine time, sun with an O. The time when Jesus, the light of the world, is on earth. These three brief years are one long day for Jesus, and it is a day of work, not a day of rest. John draws attention in verse 14 to the fact that Jesus, on this Sabbath, made mud and opened the man's eyes. And I think this is the third significance of the mud. Back in chapter 5, Jesus had healed a paralyzed man on the Sabbath with a word. But does healing with a word really count as work? Well, now he removes that ambiguity. Jesus makes mud because making stuff is definitely work. And Jesus wants to be clear that he is working on the Sabbath. Will the Pharisees accept that Jesus is the light of the world who must do his Father's work while he is on earth? Or will they relegate him to the ranks of everybody else who jolly well ought to obey the law? Let's find out. Verse 15. So the Pharisees asked asked the man how he'd received his sight, and he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see." The man's explanation is a bit shorter this time. There's really not much to say. But short as it is, his explanation divides them. Verse 16, some of the Pharisees said, this man, that's Jesus, is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. Some miss the big picture. They see Jesus miraculously heal a man born blind, and all they can think about is the day of the week that he happened to do it on. A Sabbath breaker, bad man. Others aren't so sure. He did do something pretty unusual. And what's that bit in Isaiah? He will open the eyes of the blind. Are you sure he's just another sinner? Verse 17. So they said again to the blind man, who isn't blind, what do you say about him since he has opened your eyes? He said, he is a prophet. Will precedes intellect. This man has demonstrated his willingness to trust and obey Jesus' words. And now we see that his understanding is growing. In verse 11, he talked of the man called Jesus. Now he calls him prophet. He is getting there with the help of slightly hostile questioning from these divided Pharisees. Scene 4, verses 18 to 23, the disowning parents. Verse 18, the Jews did not believe that he'd been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who'd received his sight. Actually, in the previous scene, there was no hint that the Pharisees doubted the facts of what happened. Their division was over the significance of the miracle, not over whether it happened. But they want more evidence. And so, bizarrely, they call the man's parents. Verse 19, they asked him, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered, we know that this is our son. Well, that's good, I guess. And we know that he was born blind. It would have been weird for him to have spent all these years faking it, I suppose. But now, how he now sees, we don't know. Nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he's of age. He will speak for himself. These are not the parents you want when you get into a scrape. They admit the absolute bare minimum facts they couldn't get away with denying. Yes, this is our son, yes. But then they say it's his problem. Talk to him. They effectively disown him. Just when they might have celebrated with him. But families so often are divided when one member becomes a Christian. Jesus is divisive like that. I've got some sympathy for these parents. They have to decide whether to side with their son or to side with their wider community. They are set to lose one or the other. Verse 22, his parents said these things because they feared the Jews, that is the Jewish leaders. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he's of age, ask him. Well, so much for the disowning parents. Scene 5, verses 24 to 34, the decided Pharisees. We've just glossed over it, but did you notice the Pharisees' attitude in verse 22? They had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. These Pharisees claim to be impartially weighing the evidence to decide who Jesus is and therefore whether he's done anything wrong. But everyone knows they've already decided. It's not a question of intellect, of lack of evidence. It is a question of will. They are not willing to live with Jesus as their Christ, their King. And so they will never see him that way, however much eyewitness testimony they assemble. Will precedes intellect, and the will of these people is dead set against Jesus. Do you think you just need a bit more evidence that Jesus is who he says he is before you can believe? Are you sure that it is not a lack of willingness to live with him as your King? Pray that God would give you that willingness, and then look at the evidence again. Pray that God would give your friends, your children, that willingness, and then show them the evidence again. The Pharisees have already decided to reject Jesus, but they still haven't quite decided on a strategy regarding this man. Verse 24, so for the second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God, we know this man, Jesus, is a sinner. These previously divided Pharisees are now presenting a united front. They've decided. They haven't actually asked a question, but the man does his best to answer. Anyway, verse 25, he answered, and whether he's a sinner, I don't know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. He knows it, they know it, and they don't bother denying it. Verse 26, they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, I've told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples? Do you see the Pharisees' big problem? They would not listen to Jesus' words about himself in the previous 8 chapters, and now they will not listen to the words of Jesus' newest follower. If you won't listen to Jesus' words, you will never be convinced by his miracles. There's no lack of evidence, just a fundamental lack of willingness. Verse 28, they reviled him, saying, you're his disciple, but we're disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he comes from. The man answered, why, this is an amazing thing. You don't know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone's a worshipper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Do you see the man's faith growing? In the face of hostile opposition, he's come to see that Jesus is from God in some sense, and he's come up with some pretty good arguments to demonstrate that. The Old Testament teaches that God listens to the prayers of the righteous, as the Pharisees ought to know. He's running rings around these professional Bible teachers. They give up trying to discuss it rationally and resort to personal insults and disciplinary action. Verse 34, they answered him, you were born in utter sin, and would you teach us? And they cast him out. It's the sort of thing that happens when people have already decided what they want to believe and then meet a confident Christian. So to the final scene, scene 6, verses 35 to 41, the divisive Jesus. Jesus is back, verse 35. Jesus heard that they'd cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Remember, the man had never seen Jesus. Verse 37, Jesus said to him, you have seen him now, and it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. The man has gone from thinking of Jesus as just a man, to a prophet, to being from God, now to being the Son of Man, which is a title pretty closely related to the title Messiah or Christ. In fact, he recognizes Jesus' divinity. A Jew would only worship God himself. Jesus has opened this man's eyes physically and now spiritually. This man who was willing to trust and obey Jesus' words. And now we get Jesus' theological punchline that I talked about at the start. Verse 39, Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. This is Jesus' judgment of division, his purpose in coming to earth. At first glance, it looks like Jesus is saying that before he came into the world, some people were spiritually blind and other people were spiritually sighted. And at his coming, everyone just sort of swapped places, which would be a bit weird. Actually, I think that many people feel instinctively that it's worse than that. Many people tend to think that everyone's good by nature, surely, and spiritually sighted. And it sounds here like Jesus is saying he came to push some people away. But the last two verses help us to understand that neither of those things is right. Here's what Jesus means. Verse 40. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you'd have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains. The problem with these Pharisees who overhear Jesus' conversation with man is that in their pride, they say they see everything clearly. They think they don't need Jesus to open their eyes. The very last word of the chapter is crucial. Remains. Their guilt remains. It's the same word as in John chapter 3, verse 36. Whoever believes in the Son has eternal life. Whoever does not obey the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God remains on him. Jesus doesn't make innocent people guilty. Those who reject him were guilty already. We all are by nature. He doesn't make genuinely spiritually sighted people blind, because without him there aren't any. But Jesus' presence and his miracles have this effect of confirming people who claim to be spiritually sighted in the guilt of their blindness. Remember that commentator? This chapter portrays what happens when Jesus the light shines. Some are made to see, like this man born blind, while others who think they see turn away, blinded, as it were, by the light. It's a funny story, isn't it, John chapter 9? It's funny ha-ha here and there. But it's also funny strange, this story of the divisive Jesus, whom one man comes to worship, but others come to hate. It is the story of a Jesus who came to bring that judgment of division and who will return to bring the judgment of eternal condemnation for those who reject him. But it is also the story of a Jesus who longs to open the eyes of the spiritually blind and to grow the spiritually sighted in their understanding. The question is, are we willing to obey his words? And are we willing to share his words with others, even when that brings rejection and opposition?